people talk about value, 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 right? I think a lot of investors are learning, hey, wait a minute, you know, what really pays the bills is cash flow, cash flow, cash flow.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk-takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Today on the show, I have the pleasure of welcoming back Brian Burke. Now, Brian has been on the show twice, back in 2024, and I believe back in 2017 or 2018. I'll have to go back and check the archives. But for those people who don't know who the hell Brian Burke is, let me start by telling you that he is a trailblazer in the real estate private equity space. He's a creator, he's a strategist, and someone who's built a legacy on making complex deals simple. And he's also the founder and president of and CEO of Praxis Capital and the author of Hands Off Investor, which is what we're going to be talking about a lot on today's show. And of course, over his career, he's orchestrated more than $1 billion in real estate acquisitions, everything from single flip, multifamily, all the way through to hard money lending in multifamily space, and now is in this aged care facility space. Really pumped and excited to welcome him back to the show. But without further ado, let's get him out here. G'day, Brian. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
G'day, Reid. It's good to see you again.
It's good to see you too. We were just on a multifamily mastermind. For those people who don't know, I think a few people in the industry know, but it's really cool. Every time I get off that thing, I'm like, what's it? Proximity is power, or whatever they talk about. Like, you're just hearing, you know, you're in a different league than I am, but it's always awesome to share the room with you. So, and on the show today, we also have my co-host and COO, the co-founder of RSM Property Group, Ben. How are you doing today, mate?
Doing great. I'm excited. As I was telling Brian in the green room there, I read his book many years ago. I'm a huge fan. A little bit starstruck to have the big man here. I'm excited to get to talk about his book that certainly taught me a lot about the syndication world. And yeah, excited to be here.
Well, look, and we're going to preface by saying this is a bit of a special episode of the podcast / webinar, however you want to look at it. It's going to be released on Limited in the beginning. So for people who are listening to this, you may be listening to it on one of our platforms across all the different podcasting platforms, but it has been released early to some special people in our circle. So Ben, I know you're going to do the honors today and you're going to take over a little bit here, share some screens. I would also want to say before we get started, if we are talking about stuff on visuals, we are on YouTube. So please remember to subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can search my name. You can subscribe to me at LinkedIn or on Instagram. You should subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. And remember to share and like it with friends. So Ben, over to you, mate.
Great. Well, look, I just do want to quickly plug Brian's book here and point out, you know, it's had a lot of reviews, a lot of great reviews. It's been released by Bigger Pockets. It's on Amazon. You know, you can find this very easily. And I'm not blowing smoke. This is genuinely a great book. I got a lot of value from it. I know a lot of other people got a lot of value from it. And, you know, that's really what we're going to talk about here. You know, my interpretation of the book is that one of the key themes is a lot of people look at, for example, the deal, or they're looking at the market and they're trying to figure out how to evaluate a sponsor or a deal in today's multifamily market. Brian breaks it down in a really understandable way, a way that makes sense to me, in a way that I think is accurate and resonates with the way that everyone should be looking at deals, which is first look at the sponsor, then look at the deal, and then look at the market. As he pegs it in his book, you know, do you bet on the horse or do you bet on the jockey? Do you bet on the driver or do you bet on the car? And, you know, I think we all agree at this room that you definitely need to bet on the sponsor first, then look to the deal. But the thing that people often forget is you need to look to the wider market. No matter how good the sponsor is or how good the deal is, you've also got to consider the environment you're in. So we're going to discuss that. Then we're going to do a deep dive on sponsor due diligence insofar as, you know, what are the kinds of things that you want to evaluate? What are the red flags? We'll talk about where the gotchas hide, which will be fees, waterfalls, and underwriting. And then we'll touch on debt. When Brian's book came out, the debt world was entirely different to how it is now. Obviously, with the Fed's interest rate hikes in 2022 to combat inflation, the highest and fastest in modern history, had a big impact on the commercial real estate market at the time and continues to impact today. So we want to talk about that. And then we'll kind of wrap it up. And I'm sort of stepping in as a little bit of a moderator role here because I want to hear from Brian and I want to hear from Reid. So with that said, gentlemen, any questions, any comments? Otherwise, I'm going to dive into this and start throwing some questions. And
it sounds like, mate, you would have been you would have done this for many years. I can't believe you've never been a podcast host. So well, welcome.
Yeah, it's all the webinars that you make me do, my friend. But look, let's start with the basics. So, you know, Brian, you know, again, I read your book, loved it. And the theme that you kept coming up, the first part of your book, I think the first 70 or 80 pages, it doesn't even talk about, you know, deals or the market or anything. It's like sponsor, sponsor, sponsor. So maybe just talk about that aspect of your book, your thoughts around that and that hierarchy that I outlined.
Yeah, you know, that order was not accidental. I mean, I really believe that the sponsor is the key thing when making a passive investment in real estate. I always like to say that, you know, a good sponsor can finagle the best outcome out of a bad situation, but a bad sponsor can blow up a completely good real estate deal. So, you know, if you invest with the wrong people, you can find yourself in trouble from day one. You're just set up for failure. So really putting the sponsor first in the book is, I think, how investors should consider their passive investments and putting the sponsor first. And when people ask me, oftentimes I get this question, how do I find one of these deals to invest in? I said, well, first you've got to stop asking the wrong question. Stop looking for deals to invest in and instead look for sponsors to invest with. And if you do that, you find the right people, they'll be bringing you the right deals to invest in.
Reid, what are your thoughts on that hierarchy? And, you know, let's say you were going to be investing your personal money into a deal that's not an RSN deal. You know, what's your thought process going to be?
Firstly, it would be through Praxis, wouldn't it? I could imagine with all the new stuff that's going on now, there's nothing more than I can say. You know, I think the only thing I could probably add to is that, you know, thinking about first-time sponsors and all that sort of stuff, I think the pool or the lane has become very crowded in the last sort of 10 to 15 years. So being careful about who you know, seeing that they've got a track record is really important. That doesn't necessarily mean that a bad sponsor with not as good of a shorter track record may not be a good option as well. I think keeping in mind the beauty of the change in the Jobs Act in 2012 is that as a passive investor, you can go pick a couple of horses. And I think that is very powerful as well, because you can then diversify across not only investments, but investing theses and sponsors, which can diversify, your investment strategy. So within a niche, you can also diversify, which is pretty cool as well. So I wouldn't put all your eggs in one basket, but definitely you have an ability with the change in that Jobs Act that made it powerful for investors to choose where they put that cash.
Right. So yeah, we got to look at that sponsor, and maybe that sponsor is the one that is bringing you the great deals. And let's touch on the market for a second. Now, you know, discussing the market can be dangerous because we could talk about this for, you know, 10 hours in itself. But within the context of a passive investor looking at a deal, looking at a sponsor, looking at a deal, what should they be thinking about in regards to the market and, you know, anything around that? Brian, take it away.
Well, investing in income real estate is highly driven by demographics. And I think, if you're investing in multifamily, for example, you want to invest in places where people are moving to and avoid places where people are moving from, because the influx of demographics, the influx of population is what's driving the income that the real estate produces, which ultimately drives property value and ultimately drives your returns. So I think you should always be looking at demographics in every context. And, you know, Reid mentioned earlier that, you know, we're now investing in senior housing healthcare properties, and that one is kind of geographically agnostic because it's not driven by people moving to a certain area. It's just moved by people staying put and getting older, right? So that's a demographic wave where the population is aging. That's a demographic wave. During COVID, you had a situation where there was a lot of work from home and people were moving out of high-priced cities like San Francisco and New York and moving to lower cost areas like Phoenix, Arizona, Atlanta, Georgia, everywhere in Florida. And that movement of population was driving returns, rents, and values in those markets where people were going to. That's a different kind of demographic trend. So I think when you're thinking in the context of market, the first thing you always want to think about is demographics and where are people going or what are people doing what demographic story is giving you a tailwind to whatever investment thesis you're proposing to invest in.
And Reid, you know, with your thoughts, what do you want to share, knowing, you know, we have a macro philosophy on everything at RSN, we have markets that we target, but, you know, speak freely. What are your thoughts on the topic?
Yeah, I think I'd add another question more back to Brian would be more, how have you seen the sort of last couple of years play out, and where do you think we see, you know, because you mentioned the market trends and movement and all that stuff, but there's other issues that are affecting those markets, right? Like Phoenix, you mentioned, Austin, you mentioned, which are maybe not the best time to be buying, or maybe it is the best time to be buying. I don't know. Like there's been definitely a drawback that we've seen, and we've communicated through our, you know, through this podcast and through webinars, that we hit the peaks and we've come down. Like we're picking up assets today at 20, 30, 40% below the peaks of 2022. And you could argue that was a, you know, fictitious peak, but it's still a data point. So how do you then now look at those markets, the Sun Belts that were the darling children of the past 10 years, that you sort of break through that noise of some other stuff that are causing maybe some sluggish rents or the investors to be a little bit tepid about, you know, investing in the Sun Belt because of some other issues outside of the growth, you know, the growth story?
Yeah, well, you know, demographics is a knife that cuts both ways, right? So when you've got a lot of population influx into an area, eventually the developers are going to catch wind of that and they're going to want to build, right? And that's exactly what happened. And especially in the Southeast, you had rampant construction everywhere. And then some of the work from home practices began to cease. And it's like, now return to office is the new buzzword. And that's causing people, like, either some of them have to move back, or at least certainly some people that might have moved to some of these areas aren't moving to those areas now. So there's been another shift. So you've got them working in both directions, right? You've got all this new inventory coming on at a time when you don't have as many people moving. And that's just another angle of demographics you need to study in the market. You need to look at population growth, job growth, income growth, population movement. But you also have to look at the supply side and look at how much construction is being introduced into that area and how well that construction is being absorbed. And kind of part and parcel with all of that is you have to be aware of what's happened in the market historically. And it, you know, in the recent past, what has pricing done? And so you look at, you know, 2019 through 2021, there was a massive run up in pricing because everybody was chasing the demographic tailwind and they drove pricing to the moon, 3% cap rates. I mean, you name it. And that's just a recipe for a bubble. And eventually that's going to pop and all that has to unwind. And that's what we're seeing now. And that's why you're seeing values as low as they are. I mean, if you look at values in these neighborhoods and the prices that you can pick something up for, you know, you can buy something probably for 50% of what somebody paid in 2022, early 2022, but probably still some percentage more than this, than a different buyer would pay for the same property in, say, you know, 2018. So, you know, is there really an unwinding of value, or is there an unwinding of irrational exuberance that existed in the market? So, you know, kind of when you're looking at demographic trends, take into account also, you know, market psychology and how, you know, the actions of other buyers are impacting, you know, investment outcomes.
Yeah, a lot of good content there. And we'll cap it off there because we could very easily talk about
it. I want to keep talking. I want to get juicy.
See it in your eyes, mate. That's why I got to cap it off here. But look, so we've talked a little bit about that hierarchy. Look at the sponsor, look at the deal, then look at the market, you know, big topics. So let's talk about that sponsor due diligence. So my takeaway from the book here, my notes are, you know, you want to look at what to evaluate in a sponsor is you want to look at the track record across all cycles. You want to understand how long they've been in business. You want to talk about operational capabilities, how they communicate, how transparent they are, how aligned you are with them, you know, references, reporting, things like that. Then on the red flag side, you want to look at, you know, their team. Like, do they have a really thin operations team behind that flashy pro forma? Are there any downside sensitivity analyses? Is there more of a, hey, just trust us attitude rather than, you know, here's a lot of data and, you know, due diligence to support you? Then look at those fees and, you know, do they have a full cycle history? And I got a little quote here. The sponsor is the single biggest determinant of success. That's a quote from Mr. Brian Burke there. So, you know, big topic, Brian, but, you know, maybe do you want to speak to this, what to evaluate and what to look out for?
Yeah, well, I think one of the biggest things to consider when you're looking at sponsor, it relates to, well, let me even back up earlier than that. A lot of people think that they're investing with a sponsor because they want a sponsor that can beat the market, or they want somebody that can get above average returns, or they want somebody that can get better returns than the other guy. But that's the wrong lens to be looking at passive investing at all, and especially to be looking at a sponsor. Instead, what you want is you're hiring an investment manager, basically, and their job is to locate quality assets to invest in, structure them in a fair and correctly incentivized way. But most importantly, above all else, is that when things don't go according to plan, they're going to be able to manage their way through the adversity and be able to get to the other side of whatever troubles you're facing in a competent, professional, and experienced way. And so one of the things that you mentioned early on was about, their track record during adverse markets and, and bad market cycles. And the reason that's so important is because if they were able to survive that, that's a skill set that not every sponsor has. So the ability to navigate through that adversity and survive is what ultimately preserves your capital. And, you know, you can find or try to find sponsors that will beat returns all day long. But really, what you want is somebody that's not going to lose your money and is going to get the best return the market's going to allow them to get for you. And I think that's the priority, and that's the mindset you should be approaching it from, and not just one of like, you know, who's going to, you know, do the best at getting the highest return.
That's an interesting thing, Brian, because I think also we've been, in the last 10 years, investors have become very, with the change in the Jobs Act, and I heard Neil Barwa put it quite well, that the syndication space went from being an infant to an adolescent, right, with this sort of correction. And there's been a lot of, let's call a spade a spade, there's people losing properties left, right, and center. But how do you recalibrate investor mindsets when they've been given double-digit returns in 2 or 3 years and they're thinking that's the norm, and going back to more of a medium to long-term outcome, medium to long-term horizon, which is what historically real estate has always been?
Well, I think part of what people have prioritized in the recent past has been IRR, right? Overall returns, internal rate of return. You know, how much appreciation can you get because you got a great deal or you did some kind of value add improvement and you improve the value of the property? And people talk about value, 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 right? And I think a lot of investors are learning, hey, wait a minute, you know, what really pays the bills is cash flow, cash flow, cash flow. And the value will take care of itself as long as you can hold it long enough. So I think part of that is kind of readjusting the mindset of the investor to understand that if you can get a deposit in your account every month or quarter, that's worth a lot more than any promises of increased value in 5 or 10 years from now. And, you know, whatever the returns are going to be, they're going to be. I mean, the market is going to dictate. Well, there's two things going to dictate the returns. The market's going to dictate the returns, and how much risk you're taking on is going to dictate the returns. In other words, you know, high leverage debt can amplify returns and other things. So, you know, I think people need to look at this in the context of risk. They need to look at this in the context of certainty of return, which means cash flow. And if people make that adjustment, they're going to have investments that they're happy with. If your goal is to invest passively in a real estate syndication because you're going to get a 2x multiple in 18 to 24 months, your expectations are misaligned with what the market and any sponsor is going to be able to deliver to you, at least with any consistency. You know, maybe they get a one-off grand slam needle in a haystack once in a while. But with any rate of consistency, this is not a 20% IRR everyday business. This is a business that produces really good, diversified, levered returns in the, you know, low to mid teens, maybe high teens if you get lucky. And that's just what this is. And people need to reset their expectations from what they thought it was, maybe.
Mm. That's great. I think that what they say on Wall Street now, you can't eat IRR.
You sure can't. Yeah. And it doesn't pay the bills either.
Doesn't. Okay. Well, look, that this is all good content. I want to bring this back to sponsor due diligence. So you've got a lot of sponsors out there saying, hey, I'm going to give you that 20% IRR. And, you know, we struggle to walk that fine line when discussing with investors. They'll say, hey, I'm looking at these deals, and you want to look at the deal and give some objective feedback, but you don't want to be seen to be criticizing the competition too much. But we'll often see a deal that has, you know, crazy structures in there. They're expecting a refi in 18 months with crazy terms and this and that. And, you know, it's very challenging to hit those targets. So anyway, I want to step back for a second and talk about, you know, the sponsor due diligence here. And you mentioned operational capabilities. So you've talked about, you know, having the, you know, almost like the grit or like the know-how or just like the mental fortitude to deal with that adversity across different cycles. But speak maybe to the operational capabilities that someone should be looking to investigate in a sponsor that they might want to work with.
Yeah, well, you know, some sponsors use third-party management, and they'll have a management company that does the day-to-day property management. And, you know, you don't necessarily up front know who that is. So a lot of times people forget to ask about that, because the front lines is really where the money is made and lost. So, you know, ask about who's really in charge and what does their resume look like. Other sponsors are vertically integrated where they have their own management platform and management teams. But you also want to know what that looks like. You know, our team here has 100,000 units of multifamily experience amongst the four of us, and, you know, been in business for multiple decades. And that really speaks volumes to, you know, my team's ability to navigate through challenges, because they've been through decades of challenges, multiple cycles. And, you know, all of that experience really matters. And so whoever you're investing with, you want to know about the team that's on the front lines, who's managing those assets like day to day. And, you know, what does their experience and track record look like? It's really important.
Reid, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, look, I think it's understanding the differences also between asset management and property management, right? Like you got to understand that there's the day-to-day keeping rent paid and all that sort of stuff, but then there's the asset management level that comes over the top of it that is trying to keep or crack the whip, should you say, on the property management team to make sure they're hitting that budget or the performa or whatever it might be. And that's also just as important to understand the differences between the two, because there are, it's not just, oh, I'm going to give this set of keys to a property manager and see you later. You know, this is, you know, we'll get it. We'll collect our checks in 5 years time. It's about being at the coalface and what is the asset management's role in that day-to-day decision-making process, I think is quite important as well.
Great. Well, look, we're going to move on in a second, but, you know, rapid fire, putting you on the spot here. But Brian, you've got three questions that you want to ask a sponsor. You know, you're thinking of investing with them. What are the first three questions you or a passive investor evaluating a sponsor should be asking?
Well, I want to ask about their experience and how many market cycles they've been through, and whether they lost any money during those market cycles. And if so, why? What did they do to prevent it? And what did they learn? That's probably five questions wrapped into one, I guess.
Right. No, that is one. Two more.
That's the one. Now I got to come up with two more. So another one is I want to ask about their debt strategy and philosophy. You know, how are they, how do they feel about constructing their capital stack? Because I think behind sponsor, capital stack is probably the second largest introducer of risk, so to speak. So that certainly would be one. And then three, I would want to ask them about their investment philosophy, what they're investing in, and why they believe that's the investment to be investing in at this phase of whatever cycle that investment happens to be in.
Fantastic. Look, Reid, same one to you. You can do one to three questions, however many you come up with on the spot, buddy.
Hey, how come he only has to do as many as one? I had to do five.
No, I think, look, to echo Brian, I think they're very straight to the point questions, right? If you got all five of them answered, I think you're going to have a pretty good understanding. And if someone is not willing to share with you the good, the bad, the ugly, I think that's also telling. And I think that's where Brian was trying to get at, right? Brian, it was just like the vulnerability of saying, have you lost money, right? Like, I'm sure you know, correct me if I'm wrong, no one has 100% track record, right? And so understanding what went wrong and then what you learned to pivot, and, you know, because you're still here, still surviving and fighting to live another day. So I think though I wouldn't add too much more to that. Maybe a little bit around, just because I come from the construction management background and really in the value add space, if that's what you're looking at, is like, well, who's managing that part of it, right? And how do you control costs on that end of it? And back to the vertically integrated, I think I'll dig a little bit more in on that side of it. Whether they are vertically integrated or not doesn't really, you know, it matters, but how they, the philosophies around how they manage that team from a day to day, I think is still really important.
Yeah, just to expand on what you said there, Reed, you did bring up a good point there about, you know, the sponsors and, you know, one question that I get asked often and I think is a really good one is to tell me about your worst deal and, you know, what did you do? How did you handle it? And what did you learn from it? That's a really great question. It's a very thought-provoking question to ask sponsors. And if you get an answer like, well, you know, we really haven't had a bad deal, that just means they haven't been doing this long enough. And that proves right there they don't have the experience, because everybody that's been doing this for any length of time has had a bad deal that didn't go the way that they had planned.
I would add to that. I was going to chime in and say I ask a similar question to that. I will often, if I can, find out about a bad deal or find out about something that went bad, do as much research as I can, and then I'll politely ask them about it. And it's very telling to see how they represent the situation as opposed to what you know about the situation. You can kind of tell if someone's leveling with you and being honest, or if they're trying to skirt around it, misrepresent, you know, minimize. So that's something that I find is really useful to kind of cut to the, you know, almost character of a person when you're trying to evaluate them as a sponsor. The other thing that I would add, even though I'm not supposed to be giving my opinion, and I
Ben,
said,
what do you think?
I think that the other thing you want to think about is the trajectory of the actual sponsor's business and what they're trying to do. Are they trying to get to 20,000 doors? Are they trying to scale their internal operations in a way that creates risk to the way they operate and inherently your deals? Or are they the kind of group that does one deal a year and it's very consistent, you know, or are they somewhere in the middle? Understanding the path that operator on is important to know, you know, the journey that you're signing up for. You know, are you going to be one of 50 deals, or are you going to be, you know, the one deal they care about the most? Important question to ask. Now, with that, we're going to keep this moving. So let's talk about where the gotchas hide. So especially in the syndication space, again, we'll call a spade, fees can be a big thing. You can be misaligned. There can be hidden fees. There can be, you know, high fees. And then waterfalls, we'll talk about that and how that can be, you know, opaque, you know, how that can be structured to, you know, benefit investors, benefit the sponsor. And then underwriting, you know, is there aggressive rent growth, you know, expenses lowballed, you know, so with that in mind, Brian, fees, waterfalls, underwriting, you want to speak to those gotchas we got to look out for?
Yeah, you know, I think people tend to place a lot of emphasis on fees, and it's a bit of a controversial topic. And, you know, being a syndicator, I feel like on one hand, I'm biased because, you know, I want to defend fees. But on the other hand, I'm also a passive investor and I understand the other side of it. But the reality is that fees are a necessary evil in this business. The sponsors have to be able to cover their overhead. But I think that the question of fees relates right back, Ben, to the question that you just proposed a moment ago. And that was, what is your company's goal? You know, are you striving to get to 20,000 units? Well, if they are, they're going to need a big team to accomplish that. And a lot of times you'll find some of these syndication shops will, they'll build out this huge team to try to accomplish this 20,000 unit goal. And now they've got this major amount of overhead they've got to cover every month, which means that they have to charge high fees to cover their overhead. But worse than that is they have to transact to generate fees to cover overhead. And that means they might be getting into deals they otherwise wouldn't have if they weren't under that sort of pressure. So I think that fee structure, even more important than how much the fee really is, because most of the time you're going to find fees are within a reasonable range. And certainly if they're outside of the reasonable range of what's normal and customary in the industry, then that's something that, you know, would definitely be at least a yellow flag and probably a red flag for making an investment. But more importantly is like, why are these fees here? Are they here to support a massive amount of overhead, or are the fees kind of high because you're dealing with a group that has, you know, a few highly experienced professionals that have been working very hard for a year and a half to get the only one deal they're going to buy that year and a half. And, you know, they got mouths to feed to make that happen. I think those are two completely different things. And I'd much rather pay fees to a group that has really experienced people working really, really hard for a long time to just get a few deals than a huge team of inexperienced recent college grads out there pounding the pavement to buy 20 deals a year. And we've got to pay for all of that.
Fantastic. Reid, thoughts, yeah, buddy?
No, look, I think fees are part of what keeps the business going, right? Like, I think the other side of the coin on fees is to present one deal to an investor base, you've got to go through a lot of rocks, and that doesn't come for free. And so part of being in this business is that, you know, the going out and hunting for it takes time and effort to bring it to sort of the table, so to speak, so other investors can benefit from the deal that they found. That's just part of, I think, the business of any business you go into. You're going to pay someone for a service, and that's the service that they provide. But understanding what is overcharge and what is industry standard, I think is also very, very good. And I think as you get bigger deals, those fees should come down in terms of percentage. You know, talk about acquisition fees or asset management fees or construction management fees. There are other fees out there that sort of we've never charged, but, you know, refinance fees or disposition fees, stuff like that. I think that's when you start to get to the feeling of being feed to death. But, you know, some fees are okay. Too many fees can be over cumbersome and overbearing for the average bear.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a takeaway for, you know, people evaluating a sponsor is to be able to get a clear answer on those fees. So be able to ask, look, what is your asset management fee? What is your construction management fee? What is your acquisition fee? Do you have a disposition fee? Are there any other fees that I don't know about? And you'll often find in investment decks, these fees are like either not shown or they're hidden somewhere. And that's something that to me is a red flag. With that, let's talk about, you know, waterfalls. You know, Brian, you dedicated a lot of time in the book to talking about waterfalls, the way they can be structured. Could you maybe speak to that for us?
Yeah, waterfalls is basically the division of profit, right? So if a dollar is made, who gets that dollar and in what order do they get a claim to that dollar? That's what a waterfall is. And there's a lot of different ways you can structure it. It can go from very simple where you say, okay, it's a 50-50 waterfall. You get 50% for providing all the capital. I get 50% for doing all the work. That's the simplest type of waterfall structure. And it's a common waterfall structure in things like house flipping and things where there's a lot of work involved and maybe short investment horizons and that sort of stuff. And then you move into more complex waterfall structures where you have a preferred return, which means that you as the investor, you're going to get 100% of the distributions until those distributions equal some percent return on your money. And then after that, a split will come into play where we're going to get a split and you're going to get a split. And it might be 70-30 where the investor gets 70% and the sponsor gets 30%. It could be 80-20. It could be 50-50. I mean, it's kind of all over the board depending upon the deal. And I think what's important for investors to consider, and investors oftentimes will get so focused on some of the nuances because there's so many different ways you can calculate a preferred return based on annualized rate of return or IRR, and those are different. It could be the order of capital. It could be return of capital first and then preferred return, or it could be preferred return first and then return of capital. So all of these different little nuances really don't matter too much. What really matters is, does the way that they modeled the waterfall in what they've presented to you match the language in the agreement? And does that calculate to a return and an outcomes that are desirable for you? And I don't think you see a lot of waterfall structures that are particularly misaligning. I mean, if you're going to look at a long-term hold multifamily with just a straight 50-50 split, that would certainly be out of market. But, you know, if it's 70-30 versus 80-20 versus 60-40, that's a lot less of the equation than, you know, what kind of effort is the sponsor putting forth? What kind of risk are we taking due to other factors? You know, what kind of, how did they get this deal? Where did it come from? You know, and how long is it? All of those things all come into play. You know, most of the misalignment, I think, in passive investing comes more from maybe asset management fees or some type of fees that misalign the sponsor's interests by incentivizing them to do things that are contrary to investor interests. Waterfall's not quite as big of a culprit in that arena, I don't think.
No, it's a great point. Tell you what, Reid, you speak. Go ahead.
No, the only thing I'd add to that is just understanding the differences between when you get paid and when the sponsor gets paid. I think that's preferred returns. Do they have a preferred return? I don't know, Brian, you and I in the mastermind group was talking about, like, some deals have preferred returns and investors think that could be beneficial, but it also can cut the other way, right? And if, you know, understanding what a preferred return means, it just means the first X percent of cash flow or profits go to investors, then the sponsor gets paid. On surface, that looks really appealing. But, you know, then you've got to think about the other side. Well, if a deal goes bad or something happens, is the sponsor wanting to stick around because they've got this preferred return that's hanging over their head? Or does it make it more equitable to say it's a 90-10 split on all cash flows coming out of the deal? There's just the different ways you can split it, but understanding what those different ways are and how that incentivizes or doesn't incentivize the sponsor to do certain things is also very important.
There you go. Key takeaway for investors. If you don't understand what a waterfall is, spend some time on Google, spend some time on ChatGPT, understand those basics. Then talk with the sponsor, understand their waterfall, and make sure that you know what you're getting into, you feel good about it, and you confirm that it does align with the market in general. Underwriting, you know, we've all seen some crazy underwriting. I touched on it before with, you know, the refis that have to hit a 3% interest rate in year two, or the rent growth that's going to be 5%. Let's talk about some of those gotchas, Brian.
Yeah, well, just briefly, one note about waterfalls is there's a whole chapter on waterfalls in the Hands-Off Investor. They can learn about everything waterfall right there. But there's also a whole chapter in the Hands-Off Investor on underwriting and this very topic as well, because it's a complicated topic that a lot of people don't quite understand. Underwriting means the financial modeling done behind the scenes on the performance of an income asset, in terms of how much income it's expected to generate and where those sources of income are going to come from, as well as the expenses that are going to be required for operations of that property. And then, you know, the overall net income that results from all of that. So that's what underwriting is. And underwriting for future income requires assumptions to be made about what kind of rent growth you might see, what kind of expense growth you might see. And I think, you know, there's historically been a habit from some groups to overstate rent growth or not have supporting data about rent growth or be a little perhaps overly optimistic about rent growth. And it's not necessarily malicious. I mean, in some cases, it's financial engineering on the part of the sponsor trying to show a higher return than, you know, enough to attract investors. Other times it's just irrational exuberance on behalf of the sponsor, kind of hoping that's what the rent growth is going to be. You know, my approach to that is to look for third party outside sources of rent growth data for the submarket where this property is located. And it's a non-biased, or at least as non-biased as you can get, source of information that's not trying to sell you something. There's an old rule I have that says, anybody trying to sell me something is immediately disqualified as an expert. So that means the sponsor themselves cannot be considered the expert in the market and know what the rent growth is. But if they have an outside expert showing, here's a report showing forecasted future rent growth in this submarket, maybe that's something that you could reasonably see in modeling. But one comment I want to make about modeling right now, there's a lot of sponsors losing properties to foreclosure, losing deals, having to sell at a loss. And none of that is happening because of bad underwriting. It's happening because of an improper capital stack. So investors tend to place so much emphasis on the underwriting, and then they completely ignore how the capital stack is constructed. So while it's important to think about underwriting, look at it, look at the assumptions, give them a reasonableness test, Ask for third-party supportive data to support theses on growth rates, current market rents, a market study, rent comps, sales comps, prevailing cap rates, all of those things. It's important to double check and cross-reference that stuff. Don't do that and then check the box and go, okay, we're good. I don't care what kind of debt you put on it because the underwriting looks solid.
Absolutely. Reid,
we're segueing into such an important topic, which is what's caused a lot of people some issues over the last couple of years. And that's, you know, high leverage, floating rate debt, right? And yes, as rent growth assumptions are very important in a negative rent environment, if that's what we're in. So growth assumptions are very, very important. I think another one on the underwriting I'll just add is how much, you know, one thing I've always looked at from a value add, and let's just call it medium of the road value add, you add in a couple hundred, you know, $100 to some renovations. I've always thought sort of a 7 to 10%, maybe 11% NOI growth per year, you know, over the life of the deal was within reason. You know, maybe core plus might be around 4 to 6%. And then, you know, really opportunistic stuff would be, you know, above 12% per year. I think if you're seeing more than that, or if it's above that 12%, you know, it's even 10%, like, I'd be cautious, right? Like, because you know, we've done enough underwriting to know that if you're going to buy an asset at $100,000 a door, you're going to sell it at $150,000 a door. That's a 50% value increase. That's going to give you a mid-teen IRR to investors over a five-year hold. We've done enough underwriting to know that the basic math there. If you're trying to get to a $200,000 door exit number, well, that's just, you didn't double the value. That does the NOI growth support that, number one? And we have this graph on our underwriting that shows a gut check, right? So it maps out the T12 and gives a bit of a line of best fit, and then it maps out our pro forma. And if our pro forma is going out of a 45-degree angle and the existing T12 is at a 5% angle, then you know that something's going wrong, right? So visual things like that internally are really important as you compare what, you know, and you got to take historical data with a bit of grain of salt, but just how you really are projecting out over the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, I think is also important.
It's great. And look, before we run out of time, let's wrap the underwriting topic here. We'll talk about debt, and then we'll talk about any key takeaways here. We'll have to be quick on debt. But, you know, underwriting. So I think, you know, my takeaway for investors is understand the underwriting, read Brian's book, but ask them about those key assumptions, you know, rent growth, NOI growth, and, you know, try to look at that in the market. Make sure that the sponsors are making data-driven decisions. Like Brian says, well, oh, you got 5% rent growth. Do you happen to have a report, a third-party report that, you know, backs that up? So questions like that are going to be really pertinent to understanding the underwriting. And the last thing I'll say very quickly, ChatGPT is rapidly becoming very good at evaluating pitch decks. So you can put that in there, ask some questions, ask it, hey, what would you be asking the sponsor about this? And you can't always trust AI, but it's a great place to start. So with that, let's talk about debt. And Reid, I'm going to let you talk about debt because you were about to get into it, you know, fixed rate, floating rate, where we are in the cycle, and just what do you need to be thinking about as a passive investor when a sponsor's got a certain debt stack? What questions are you asking?
Yeah, well, hindsight's 2020, right? You always look back and say, you know, we had a 10 years ago, 11 years ago when we got started, it was all, you know, positive leverage deals. You're going in with, you know, interest rates less than going in cap rates and, you know, pretty much fixed rate debt. We got into a bit of a sticky situation there in 2019, 2020, where going in cap rates were higher than some of the interest rates they're putting on the deals, you know, betting on the come of rent growth. I think that's where a lot of sponsors got into some trouble, particularly when not only that interest rates went up, but also that rent growth flattened or had flattened. So that's, you know, you're further underwater. Goes back to that NOI comment I made earlier about what's that NOI growth over year on year. And so then how do you mitigate around that? Okay, so if you are getting bridge debt because it might be the deal might not qualify for agency, understanding, well, why doesn't it qualify? You know, what's happened to it, and how are you going to mitigate if you are going to get floating rate debt? And is there a path to getting agency debt on the property? And for those people who are not familiar with agency debt, you know, agency debt is the gold standard of debt here in the multifamily space. Bridge debt is a tool that should be used and can be used in certain situations, but you've got to use it wisely because it has, it has higher leverage, and higher leverage comes with inherent risks when what we saw play out in the last couple of years comes to fruition, where interest rates go up and asset values go down. Anything else to add to that, Brian? That was a quick summary. We're trying to get the show wrapped up here.
Yeah, I think the one other key element, and I think probably, in my opinion, the most important element is the maturity date of the loan. And, real estate is an investment over time, right? You want to harvest rent growth. Rent growth comes over time, over a series of years. You want to see the price appreciate, which comes over a series of years. You've got to give yourself the time for that to play out. And so a lot of the loans that were going out were 3-year maturities, which just simply wasn't enough time. And if you get an adverse market cycle during that hold period, you could be forced to sell at the bottom of that adverse market cycle with no other way out, even if that requires selling at 100% loss. So having longer term maturities is what gives you the time to allow real estate to do what real estate does, which is go up over time. If you don't give yourself the time to do that, you don't give yourself the opportunity to harvest that. And I think that's probably one of the most important things you need to look for is how much time is the lender giving you for your thesis to play out?
Awesome. Awesome. Such good content here, guys. So let's bring it home. Again, the topic here is how to evaluate sponsors and deals in today's marketplace. So what haven't we covered? What do you want to hit on again? What advice do you want to be giving to investors that maybe in the beginning of their journey in the multifamily space, they want to get in, they want to look at a sponsor, a deal, the market? With all of that context in mind, what would you say to send us home, Brian?
I would say step one, find the right sponsors to invest with. You want somebody that has market cycle experience, full cycle experience, and just general experience and experience in the asset type that they're acquiring and in the market they're acquiring it in. All those pieces of experience are critical. The second thing you want to look at is how is the debt and capital stack structured? How much time do you have for your real estate investment thesis to play out? And then assuming that you've got the right sponsor, you've got the right debt, you've got a long period of time, then look at that underwriting and make sure all the assumptions make sense. And then you probably have yourself a winner.
Awesome. And Reid, same question, comment to you. Take us home.
Brian did my bit for me at the end there where I summarized the show. So no, I don't have anything else. I think that's incredibly insightful, Brian. And thank you for jumping on and just sharing all your knowledge. So Ben, back over to you.
It's good. So I'm stealing your host role and Brian's stealing your expertise role,
I'll sail off in the sunset, guys. I'm not even here.
Oh, look, it's great. This has been really good content. I know our investor base is going to really like this. So, thanks so much, Brian. Thanks so much, Reid. I mean, Reid, it's your show. You want to close us out here?
Yeah, for the podcast and people listening on wherever you subscribe, please give us a 5-star review, share it with your friends. We're going to do it all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.